97.9 FM and 1360 AM WCHL and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus is dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, journalism professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, sexual assault by athletes on college campuses. Our guest, Diana Moskovitz, staff writer for Deadspin. Diana is based in Los Angeles. Diana, you've written about this a lot, and I want to start by talking about a couple of very specific cases. Let's go FSU first. There has been a settlement in the FSU case, almost $1 million to the woman who claimed that she was raped. And beyond that $1 million, there was a bunch of other money spent. What was that spent on and who paid it?
Well, what I believe you're talking about is the attorney's fees. When Florida State settled, they made this big show about saying how they were settling to save money on attorney fees. That said, then in talking to Erica Kinsman's attorneys, FSU was vastly overinflating their fees, which they didn't want to get into, but they said they were not taking nearly as much as FSU said that they were. And it, to me, it just showed how even in the end with these universities, the spin cycle never stops. You know, there's always trying to put a spin on it, always trying to blame someone else, like attorney fees or regulations or these federal privacy laws we just have to follow. There's very little, if ever, agency or acceptance or admission on the part of the universities themselves. And you know, even with that settlement, I'd like to point out something that Kizzo pointed out to me a couple of times, that while that settlement was pretty big, they believe it's the largest yet in a Title IX case, it's still nothing compared to the average booster donations to an athletic department. And if you really want to be a cynic, which I certainly can be at times, you could argue that that settlement was, you know, to some of these boosters, that's just a check, and that's nothing to them at all.
Yeah, I wanted to get into it because whatever the amount of the attorney's fees, according to your reporting, the state of Florida wound up paying some of that money and Seminole Boosters wound up paying the rest. So actually, the university was not on the hook for any of it.
Right. It was. Thank you for bringing that up. It was especially because the FSU, remember, it's a state-funded university. So what ended up happening was that part of what they paid was covered by essentially the state because they're a state entity. And I believe that was the Florida Emergency Management Fund, if I've got the name right. That covered part of it. And then the rest, it was actually a group called Seminole Boosters, which stepped up and agreed to pay the rest. And so if you look at how much actually was paid by FSU, and again, mind you, this is after they made this huge deal. Oh my gosh, we have to settle this case. If we don't settle it, we're going to run out of money. We have to settle this, not because we did wrong, but you know, for the sake of you know future students and future professors, we have to save this money. To then have it come out that actually none of it came out of FSU's pocketbooks at all. They were completely fine. Literally, not even a dime came directly out of the Florida State University budget.
Okay, so we have that issue at FSU involving Jameis Winston, who's now playing pro ball. And Baylor is another one where we've seen just story after story. I think it's eight women have brought suit against Baylor. We had a former player who was cleared by the university investigation, but then found guilty in the criminal courts, and the university investigation has the lower standard. So how do you explain all that?
Yeah, really tricky, right? How are you found guilty in a criminal court but somehow cleared by a university, which, like you said, as mandated by the federal government, has to use a lower standard? what we know with Baylor, actually a lot of it came out, and this credit goes to the prosecutors there in Waco, Texas. During the trial, they talked about the investigation that Baylor did. This was as part of arguing if Baylor's investigation could be submitted to the court as evidence or not, and talked about to the jurors. And in fighting it, the prosecutors talked about, they showed us basically what a horrible investigation it was, which was why it was not allowed in court, where they basically, it's a mix of Baylor doing sort of just the bare minimum and not trying very hard. And, you know, perhaps even if you want to give them the benefit of the doubt, just not knowing what they were doing. You have a situation where they talk to the football player and the woman, and then just each to one of their friends. Sam Lukuachu had a friend who swore he was there and didn't hear anything, which he told Baylor. Prosecutors were able to disprove that he was there with cell phone information from his cell phone showing he was somewhere else. Baylor did not get the full medical results from this woman. Very soon after what happened, she went to a hospital. She had a rape kit done. The nurse who administered it, I believe, actually testified at trial. But they did not get those and had very squishy reasons as to why. They are medical records, but they never even asked the woman who had been raped if she could give them a copy, which she could have. They are her records. So they didn't get those records, but they hadn't tried very hard to get them. And it was just this, like I said, a bizarre investigation where you see a lot of things like that, where they're just sort of this mix of doing the bare minimum and not trying very hard to get what would be very key evidence. They also didn't look very hard into what the woman, this student, had gone through with her counselor. Again, another person who testified at trial about, you know, her emotional trauma afterwards and how it affected her, what she had been through. That was another thing Baylor didn't really look that hard into. And it's just sort of this example of how, with these university investigations, they have such a wide latitude over them. There's federal guidelines, but they're very vague. There's just such a huge room for them and so little eyes on them. No one's really checking in unless someone filed a complaint. So they basically do whatever they think is a fair investigation, and that's the end of it.
Sports Focus, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking about rape and sexual assault by athletes on college campuses. We're talking with Diana Moskovitz, staff writer at Deadspin. Diana, in some of your articles, you've gotten into the Dear Colleague letter and how little that means. Will you explain that?
Yes. So the Dear Colleague letter, which came out a little more than 5 years ago now, it was basically the federal government telling universities that they needed to finally start enforcing these rules, which were always there and always should have been enforced, just so we're clear. This wasn't a new law that got passed. It was the federal government saying, please start actually enforcing this as you should have been. And it basically laid out, explained to them why they need to be investigating allegations of sexual assault on campus, the idea being that it's seen as a violation of civil rights because rape and sexual assault are crimes that disproportionately affect women. It's not just women, but disproportionately affects women. And so because of that, when you ignore that and you're ignoring an issue that disproportionately affects one gender, you're essentially discriminating against that gender.
Yeah, that's right? That's where the big question comes, because, you know, if you think about the history of Title IX, it's to give women opportunities to play sports, right? You wouldn't really have thought about it in this other way.
It just says that I cannot be discriminated, or I say I because I'm a woman, based on my gender and in an educational setting. And I think people interpreted that as meaning we just need to give them their own soccer team. but there was nothing in the law itself. It's just one sentence that said this is just about sports. That's how people chose to interpret it at the time. Who knows why I wasn't around. But now through the work of a lot of, you know, advocates and activists, it has been expanded in our understanding of it to include this, in part because of cases that were very high profile that involved athletes, where women came forward and basically said, your failure to protect me is a violation of Title IX. In the past, it has been interpreted as just applying to athletics. But, I mean, that was a limitation placed on it by our own minds, our own understanding of it. If you look at it, it's just one sentence. It can go a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And it
has been expanded to include that now. So the question that arises from that is, That's a legal matter, right? That's in the courts. Why does student judicial ever get involved in something involving sexual misconduct on campus?
Well, a couple things. I mean, first of all, if you talk to folks who are involved with student judiciary, they'll point out that, you know, they handle a lot of things. They also handle civil rights in terms of if someone's accused of racist behavior on campus. So while this is what's getting a lot of attention, it's not truly unprecedented or unheard of. I mean, again, we have civil rights on campus in terms of, again, if someone were to, you know, use a derogatory slur, you could bring that before student judicial. That would also be a case. A lot of this has to do with essentially special protections we've placed around education, because I think rightfully so. We all think it's incredibly important, and we want everyone to have equal access to it, because that makes us all better people, better humans, better society. Where it really gets tricky, and I will borrow something that was first said to me by an activist on this issue, Kathy Redmond Brown, which was that normally with a crime that's so serious like this, because the victim, you know, she compared it to murder, where if there's a murder, we all immediately go to the police, and the police investigate, and there's this very quick resolution, hopefully. And it's not that student judicial wouldn't get involved on that. It's just they wouldn't have to, because the police get involved, they make an arrest. Whereas with rape, it's such a serious crime, and a crime which, for various historical reasons, which we can go over or not, a lot of women have been hesitant to go to the police, and understandably so. Law enforcement has a very poor history of handling these crimes throughout the country. So what you're seeing is women who've been raped, and they want something done, and they may or may not go to the police. I know you have a case there at Chapel Hill where the woman said she went to both. So now they're also going to, you know, essentially student judicial affairs, because they have this second option through Title IX. You know, I always say that I feel like a lot of women who have been raped are just looking for a system that doesn't suck. And I think that's what we, in some parts, see, you know, playing out here with Title IX. You know, there's one activist on the issue who's talked openly about when she was raped, she was told not to go to the police. So that's intertwined with this as well. There is a very long and prominent history of law enforcement just not handling sexual assault well at all, of just, you know, telling women they weren't really raped, of saying, well, you have no case, you know, don't even bother. And so part of that, what is intertwined with this, is women not wanting to take that, you know, as an answer. And so, yeah, looking at these other systems like Title IX, you know, which is there and which they're taking advantage of, as they should.
Sports Focus. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sports Focus and our discussion with Diana Moskovitz, a staff writer for Deadspin, about rape and sexual assault on campus. Diana, we have only a few minutes left, but I do want to get into the idea that opponents of this movement, if you will say, well, there are, what about false rape allegations? And the numbers vary widely. I've seen anywhere from 2% to 25%. But let's go with the 25, just for the sake of argument. That means that 75% are true, even if you go with that large number. So somewhere between 75 and 98% of the claims are true. And yet, you know, you have the Rolling Stone issue with the Jackie story. It's totally false. How much weight should investigators, either the police or student judicial, give to these young women? Shouldn't it be at least 75%?
You know, what always gets me is I used to be a breaking news and crime reporter back in South Florida, and I'm always amazed at how this concern about false allegations exists with rape, and it just doesn't exist with any other crime. I think with any other crime, we say, okay, a police report has been made. You know, we read the report, you know, and then we wait for the police to investigate and prosecutors to investigate and file charges. And we just sort of accept it for as it is. And there's this huge faith, and perhaps disproportionate faith in the system and that it gets it right. Well, we obviously know that the system sometimes gets all crimes wrong, including murder. And yet, for some reason, with this one, there's immediate concern that it's a lie, that it's made up, that she's a gold digger, that she's out for money. And I really think what women want, what all victims want, is they just want a fair chance with the system. And I just don't see why we can't just say they'll investigate it like they would investigate anything else. You interview witnesses, you check for evidence, you try to confirm stories. You know, it should just be treated like any other crime. And for various reasons that we don't have time to get into, because it's a lot of historical stuff to unpack, there is a presumption that women are liars. Unfortunately, the truth is, people lie with all crimes, which I've wrote about before. With all crimes, there is an element of false reporting.
Ryan Lochte, come to mind?
This is one where we hold that against anyone who immediately reports it and demand 100% accuracy. Obviously, the system should aim for 100% accuracy. But the truth is that it does not have it with this crime or any crime. And yet this is the one where it gets held against victims.
I was talking to Nancy Hogshead Makar last week about this very subject, and the concept of the failure to say no does not mean yes. And she said what you really should look for in a sex partner is enthusiastic consent. And then a lot of these questions would go away.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this has to do with the way we do or don't even understand sex and what a lot of people unfortunately may or may not believe is okay, and unfortunately what people may or may not believe that they can get away with. I'll pull an example not from college, but I think right now with the Derrick Rose case, part of the reason that has gotten a lot of tension is because there's this quote where, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and him and his men are going over to this girl's apartment where she says that they raped her. They say it was consensual. And he's being asked under deposition, well, why did you talk about this? Like, why are you going over to her place that, you know, it's now 1:30 in the morning? And Derrick Rose says something effective like, oh, well, what was there to talk about? And he says the quote, we be men. You know, there's nothing to talk about. It's 1:30 in the morning. We be men. Of course, why else would we go over? And I think it's not a coincidence that that quote has gotten so much attention, because I think it really speaks to what we're really talking about right now and what you referenced from your past show, which is, you know, our attitudes towards sex and what is okay. And maybe I'll call it a moment right now where that's changing, you know, and where we're really talking about it. And I even look back on my time in college and things that, you know, me and my female friends, you know, at the time just shrugged off and said, oh, whatever, that's just boys being boys. And that's just stuff we have to deal with because we're women. And I look at it now and I know that that's wrong, you know, and we shouldn't have just allowed that. I think our attitudes are shifting and changing, and in ways that at least seem to be good and healthy and positive. Yet also pushing against a lot of stuff like we be men.
Yeah. And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Diana Moskovitz. Thanks also to engineer Dylan Field. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance, and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.